Tonight on Arena, Holly McNish is frank, honest and unashamedly open in her new book, Slug and Other Things I've Been Told to Hate, and Richard Moss on turning a military weapon into a documentary camera. Holly McNish is the award-winning poet with collections including Plum and Cherry Pie. She's also collaborated with Kay Tempest and George the Poet, and in 2014 released Versus, an album featuring her spoken word poetry both with and without music. She's also a performance poet, selling out large venues with her readings and clocking up millions of views on YouTube. Her new book, Slug and Other Things I've Been Told to Hate, is a hybrid of poetry, prose and memoir, and features her trademark honesty about topics that many find taboo, from Finnish saunas, unfulfilled ladybirds and Patrick Swayze, to grief, grandparents and menstruation. Slug explores the human condition with humour, insight and wit, and delighted to have Holly McNish join me this evening. I suppose really the section that the book opens with, Holly, in some ways sets a tone for the book, for me at any rate, and it has to do with the death of your beloved. It was Gran that you called this particular grandmother, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Gran. I actually called her Gaga, but I thought that was a bit too much for the reader to start off with. So yeah, that was Gran.
And when did she die?
She died during the first lockdown.
And that cannot have been an easy time.
No, it was rubbish. It was really rubbish. But I'm really lucky that it sort of eased slightly before then, and I'd gone up to see her when she was in hospital, and then she was at home and my mum was with her. And it was, I guess, as people say, it was sort of as good a death as you can possibly get, which I think is really important. But yeah, I couldn't go to the funeral, couldn't go and see anyone afterwards, which I know a lot of people had. And that was really the rubbish part as well.
Well, let's listen to how you've expressed some of those difficulties and disappointments in the poem, Chasing Ceremony, / Convincing Myself.
Okay. Actually, I wrote this poem just after watching her funeral live streamed on the internet. Chasing Ceremony, Convincing Myself. I'll not get to your funeral. That's fine. I know you'll not make mine. You hate the fussing anyway. Your favourite colour's yellow, not black. On your street, when next door died too soon before you did, neighbours clapped a passing hearse as if the corpse were on a royal tour. You turned towards your daughters. Here, don't you dare do that for me. Hair cradled into rollers each night until the night you left, still lifting life with curls. The laws do not allow me to stand and watch a lifetime exit puppet show-sized curtains as tears try to console each other 2 metres apart. The only good things are the sandwich platters afterwards anyway, and we can't even have those. So I'll celebrate you here, 300 miles from home. Wear that butter-coloured jumper you once said made me pretty. Wallow in self-pity as if your loss is all my loss. Let lips tremble all they want. Eyes swell to embarrassed red, too obvious a grief to meet with any friends, even with the recommended coffin space between us. No need for all that, huh? Who cares about it, right? I already said I love you so many times in life. Each time I said I love you, each postcard that I sent, each nightie that you lent me, each evening that we wasted watching pre-records of Countdown at a volume that I'm almost sure has pierced some of my eardrum, in refining just that splash of milk to slightly hint your tea with, till you looked inside the cup again and smiled and said, that's perfect.
Holly McNish with her poem Chasing Ceremony, / Convincing Myself, and that's from her new, I'm going to say collection, Holly, actually, Slug Slug and Other Things I've Been Told to Hate. Now, I'm saying collection, but it in no way describes the range of forms that you have in the book. Just explain how the book, first of all, the range of material, themes, we can't go into everything, but just how you've laid it out in terms of poems, prose, etc.
So yeah, I like the word collection. I'll go with that. But yeah, so it's cut into 7 sections, all things that I've been told to be sort of embarrassed about or to hate. So things like grief or sexual things or menstruation or my parents, lots of different topics. And each section has got the poems that I wrote, but then it's also got the sort of either stories or memoir or like research around the poem. So I guess the reason why I wrote the poem, I also put that in the book because I really like knowing the background to poems when I read poetry collections. I just like being in a place where I can understand the poem.
Yes, yeah, so to a certain extent, then we get the poems. We get they're almost like essays in some ways. But then at the end of each section, I think they're mostly at the end of each of the sections, there are these stories, short stories, some of them in verse, if I remember correctly. Is the idea of the short story, is that a slightly new departure? Because you've done the poetry prose mix before.
I've done the poetry prose mix before because it's just how I write my poems. I write my diaries, sort of essays and poems and stories in them. The short stories I put in purely for fun, basically. So they're sort of related to the sections a wee bit, but you can definitely read it all without going in any order. But I just love writing stories. And I think after I'd been writing loads of poems about my own life and topics that I still find embarrassing, it was just really nice to get into a bit of fiction where I could just write a story about a horny ladybird or a naked cat. I like all the different forms of writing and I like the different forms of reading. So I thought I'd just sort of shove it all together in the book and you could pick and choose what you like.
And in fact, at the very beginning of the book, you say, you give us 7 ways to read this book. I suggest that there are probably a lot more than 7 ways to read it. But I was interested to see that one of the things you suggested, look, if you just want to read the poems, that's absolutely fine. Throw all that silly old prose to the one side and let's get to the cream of the crop in the poetry. Is that what you were telling us there?
Well, yeah, just because some people know me just through the poems and they just want a poetry collection. So I put an index at the back of just the poems. And also some people, they like being a bit confused with poems. Like my poems, they're never going to really confuse people that much. They're pretty straightforward, I think, to read. I think some people don't want that. They want to have to read a poem a few times and sort of work out what it's about. So that was about that, really. But also I said that you could just read the prose just because I had a woman at a gig, which I said in the book, saying, oh, I really liked your book, but I just skipped the poems, obviously, because I hate poems. So I thought, all right, fair enough, if you really want to.
But you had to admit to committing such an offence as a child reader as well, didn't you, in terms of skipping the poems?
Yeah, I did. Like, I loved children's poems. I loved a lot of poems, but I really got annoyed with Roald Dahl books. Like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, they had a lot of songs, sort of songs and poems. And I weirdly used to get angry when I was reading it and just skip them and get to the story. I thought it broke up the story too much.
Yeah, there you go.
I can't really be annoyed with people that do that.
You can't, and you don't. You're not predictive about how we should read it. But I'm interested in what you said there about, you know, nobody's going to be too confused or certainly find the hidden aspects in your poetry. You like to avoid what you refer to as the secret codes of poetry. What do you mean by that, first of all, Holly, and why do you think it's important?
It's not so much that it's important. Like, I love reading poems that are way more surreal than my own poems. I really like all of it. But I think that the way that I write and the reason I write poems is for myself, basically. It's always been the way I've written my diary ever since I was a little kid. And not to put myself down, and I don't mean it in a bad way, but I think the way that I think about stuff is quite simple. Like, I like to simplify thoughts because the world is pretty complicated, and I get pretty angry about a lot of stuff. But poetry has always been one of the ways that I've tried to, I guess, sort of condense my thoughts. So I'm not really using poetry in order to make something more complicated than it already is in my head. I'm sort of using it for the opposite. So I think that's why my poems, they don't tend to be poems that you could find new stuff reading them again and again, but I don't think you'd not understand what the context was just reading it once.
And those sections that the overall collection is divided into then, endings, growing up, parenting, mirrors, masturbation, blood, strangers. I mean, the two that certainly jumped out at me when I was looking at in terms of title was obviously the masturbation section, which has the subtitle Ringing the Devil's Doorbell, and Blood, which is all about Rambo in Finland, and this is the section that deals specifically with menstruation. Are these just topics that you found yourself writing about, Holly, and then subsequently saying, yeah, I'll put all of that together? Do you think it's really important, if I'm not using a word you're going to pick me up on again, do you think it's important to write about topics that people don't generally write about?
So I didn't do it on purpose. I was putting this book together and I realised that I'd been writing loads of poems. It's quite boring probably to write poems about masturbating rather than just do it, to be honest. I sort of was laughing at myself afterwards, but I'd written quite a lot of poems about that. And I've just been writing about these topics. And actually a lot of the poems in this book were poems. Some of them I wrote a couple of years ago. Most of them are pretty new. But I realised I was sharing them less than other poems as well. So they were more the things that I was writing about, but not sharing, because I write about everything that's on my mind, and then I sort of pick and choose what I'll then share on social media or maybe put into a book. So yeah, I seem to be writing a lot of poems about not just masturbation, but like the sort of female sexuality or the way things are shamed a lot. So the sort of, I think shame is a lot of people think it's a real problem, which is why I called it ringing the devil's doorbell or giving the devil a handshake, I think is the male equivalent. I learned from the Blind Boy podcast.
Yeah, people can work that out for themselves. I will move swiftly on to the parenting section. Is it gin o'clock yet? Again, you know, I find myself laughing at the title of the section, and as I read through the essays and the poetry, I thought, Holly's been a lot more serious about this topic than I actually expect her to be. In other words, there are serious points to be made here.
Yeah, there are. So a lot of the parenting section hopefully is quite funny. There's a lot of stuff about sort of boredom as well. But the gin o'clock one, yeah, it's more serious. I just think parenting or coping with parenting is way more political than we ever think. But I think I feel the same about a lot of these topics, parenting, sort of sexuality, pleasure. You don't expect politicians to really be having a say in that, but I think they do. I think, like me finding parenting difficult, a lot of it is just to do with the physical pregnancy and labour. You know, I'm not saying that the politicians are defining that for me, but the sort of healthcare system and how easy or not easy it was to breastfeed or to go back to work, or, you know, all of that stuff is really political. And I think we tend to think, especially a lot to do with women and motherhood or parenthood, we tend to think it's this sort of private domestic thing, but it's real public thing, and politics has a lot to do with how well we can do it and how much we struggle.
A lot of your cultural life has gone online, particularly since your poem Embarrassed, which was about breastfeeding, in fact, 7 million views on YouTube. Yet you've spoken before about, you know, to be referred to as simply a YouTube poet. It's quite reductive. What are the benefits? Yeah. What are the benefits? What are the pitfalls then of the YouTube generation and the first of all, the uplift it gives you in one sense, but that reductive thing that you seem to be slightly anxious about?
So the reductive thing is really just, I guess every time I sort of put poems on a different social media, people that want to criticise the poems, which is fine, is obviously it's not for everybody, and there's lots that I can improve in my writing. But I tend to be sort of labelled with the social media outlet that I'm using to share them, which I think is sort of ridiculous, because you wouldn't do that with the painting. You know, I don't see a painting on Instagram and somebody calls that painter an Insta poet, an Insta painter, as if, you know, it doesn't change my poetry whether I share it on YouTube or Instagram or Twitter or anything. But it tends to be used sometimes as a bit of a slight, like this isn't proper poetry. Even if I'm, you know, taking a picture of a page from this 400 page book and putting it on Instagram, it'll still quickly deem me an Insta poet.
Well, listen,
we'll
finish up.
I don't mind.
I get what you're saying. We'll finish up, if you wouldn't mind. Maybe you'd lead us into, without giving the poem away, obviously, some of the ideas in The Boy in the Pearl Earrings.
Yeah, of course. So The Boy in the Pearl Earrings is in the section on growing up. And there's a lot in that section just about the dress codes that we've had for what we see as male or female people for thousands of years, and how ridiculous I find our anger towards people that just want to wear slightly different clothing, or clothing that you don't deem appropriate for them. So this is called The Boy in the Pearl Earrings. And if you look at the author photo on the book, this poem refers to the author photo. I won't say more than that. You'd have thought another comet struck the day we caught their only son clipping on his mother's bra, toddling stiletto stilts, gaping gap from skin to heel, the way I used to wobble, spiralling my mum's fake pearls before scavenging my father's clothes, shirt skimming skinny knees, jacket tents and tartan ties, as everybody laughed with me and no one seemed to mind as I transitioned girl to boy to girl to boy, and mum mascara'd me a moustache above my grinning lips, and my uncle took a photograph and someone shouted, "Just a minute, man," placed a beer can in my left hand, cigarette into my mouth.
Holly McNish reading her poem The Boy in the Pearl Earrings, and that's from her new collection Slug and Other Things I've Been Told to Hate, which is published by Fleet. In 2016 and 17, the photographer and video artist Richard Moss made two new installations, Incoming and Grid Moria, about the migration crisis in the Mediterranean, a human tragedy which was playing out nightly on TV news bulletins at the time. Incoming shows refugees on the move in war-torn Syria, Senegal, Afghanistan, Iraq and Somalia, while Grid Moria focuses on the Moria refugee camp on the Greek island of Lesbos. Both were filmed using military-grade thermal cameras, which can react to body heat at great distances. The installations are about to receive their Irish premiere at the Butler Gallery, a kind of homecoming for Moss, who lives in New York but grew up in Kilkenny. But I'm delighted to say that Richard Moss is speaking with me this evening on Arena. It must be quite an exciting aspect or prospect, Richard, to be bringing these installations home, as it were, to Kilkenny.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, no, it's a delight. Obviously, I grew up in Kilkenny and I'm very familiar with the Butler Gallery, having, you know, played around in its galleries as a young boy during its openings many, many years ago. And my family were kind of involved in helping get it going. And then Anna O'Sullivan, the curator, who has worked very hard to bring it out of the basement of the Kilkenny Castle and to find a larger premises for it in an old almshouse, has relocated the gallery in Kilkenny City very recently. And she's worked for, I would imagine, more than a decade to do that. And I worked with Anna. She was the commissioner and curator of the Irish Pavilion in 2013, which I was the artist for. It's a great honour to represent Ireland. Yeah. So I have a bit of history with Anna O'Sullivan and with the Butler Gallery.
For sure. And I guess the whole idea of bringing something home is very useful in terms of thinking about the subjects that you're dealing with here in both Incoming and Grid Moria. I was thinking today that it really is a reminder, both of these installations are a reminder that before COVID, there were other humanitarian crises looming large, and those crises have not gone away in the meantime. Just tell us the kind of images that we see in both installations.
Oh, exactly. So both these works were made with the same camera, a very specific military-grade thermal imaging camera designed by a multinational weapons company here in Europe. And it's designed specifically to image human body heat from a great distance to detect, track and target insurgents. So it's used as parts of weapon systems itself. It's regarded as classed in terms of export control. It's classed as a weapon. So this is not a normal camera we would use for storytelling or for the telly. This is a camera that's it's designed to be put on sentry posts in the desert or on the coast to detect refugees, insurgents, people trying to illegally immigrate, as they say, into Europe. It's designed for long-range border surveillance, as well as battlefield situational awareness and for search and rescue. So it's a very specific, powerful thermal imaging camera. And it can image human body heat from a distance of 30 kilometres or 18 miles, day or night.
Extraordinary, extraordinary that. And when you talk there, Richard, about detect, track, target, we're obviously talking military manoeuvres here, and when you detect, track and target something, it's not to look after it, it's to do serious harm to the whatever it is that you happen to be detecting, tracking and targeting.
How much of an irony, what was the feeling for you about turning this military-grade weapon, let's face it, into something totally different, with a totally different use and totally different outcome?
Exactly, yeah. So I'm trying to use it against its original purpose, and in a way, very literally against its... You know, this medium, this technology is very much embedded in this idea of Fortress Europe, in the ways in which we're essentially trying to prevent refugees, who many of whom are fleeing conflicts in which we are complicit, and which we're partly responsible for, places like Syria and Iraq and you know, in the Sahel. And these refugees are trying to simply claim asylum in Europe. And the ways in which we, instead of welcoming them, and according to international refugee law, and these are treaties that we have ratified, our nations have ratified following World War II, when many of our families would have been displaced across Europe. We enshrined international refugee law, the human rights of the refugee. And now in recent years, we're, I think, forgetting that responsibility. And instead of upholding those laws, it's not just an ethical responsibility, it's a legal one. We're putting our resources in Europe into institutions like Frontex, and finding all kinds of ways to tinker about with immigration policies in ways that undermine the rights of the refugee. And this camera itself is really a facet, an aspect, or you know, a way of thinking, at least for me, through some of the ways in which we're failing the refugee, because it's designed specifically to build the walls of Fortress Europe, yeah, in a way. So I found it, instead of, I suppose, turn it against itself in a way, to try to reveal for the viewer some of the struggles that are literally being unfolding, historical situations that are unfolding in front of me and the lens, to show people on a testimonial level what I've seen, which is the power of the documentary image, but to sort of fold that in with this reflexive sort of the problem of the medium itself.
Yeah, because I wanted to ask you about the specifics of that medium, because obviously there's quite a political aspect to what you're saying there in terms of turning this weapon, this camera, back in itself and how you're using it. But what about the aesthetic aspect of things? Because this is an installation and there's an artistic component obviously involved as well. What aesthetic did this image technology give to you that perhaps you wouldn't get from a regular camera?
That's a very good question. Yeah, no, it's an extremely unfamiliar kind of medium. You know, I'm very interested, as a photographer, I'm very interested in photographic technologies that are unusual, that can reveal invisible forms of light. And I've been chasing my tail in that regard for more than a decade. And this one sees medium wave infrared, which is literally, you know, human body heat, the radiance of our biological essence, and as a result, it sort of shows the corporeality of us, of our vein circulation, of our breath, the respiration, of the sweat coming down, which you usually couldn't really see, but this is really graphically revealed as little tears on our faces and. And our eyes themselves, you know, you can't see the pupil. Our eyes are represented as a sort of a black jelly. And it's a very sort of ghostly, haunting way of imaging the human body. And the body is really foregrounded in this work because of the precarity, the vulnerability of each of us, but especially those, you know, traveling across the sea, risking their lives, sometimes drowning or falling to hypothermia, or crossing the Sahara Desert, that, you know... The sort of vulnerability of the human body to the elements is foregrounded in this work, and I'm hoping would remind the viewer of the very struggle of the refugee on a kind of visceral level.
Yeah, and I suppose the images in some ways, they look not exactly like like the negative that we would know from an old film in a camera, but they're not dissimilar to that aspect in that there's a very black and white monochromatic aspect to the image that we see. But heat is hugely important in terms of how the camera picks up the images and displays those images to us. Heat, I think, is an interesting idea, given what we're talking about here, given that we're talking about people moving from one place to another in search of shelter, essentially.
Exactly. If you're living in a tent with your entire family and you're in a, you know, constantly being displaced, constantly moving by foot often, or by a little boat you don't know how to drive, and washing up on the shore, on a cold shore in the middle of the night, forced to try to dry off and stay alive. And, you know, these are really, really difficult struggles. These people are going to risk their lives to get out of very dangerous places. And I think that's a very overlooked set of narratives that, you know, we tend not to want to see. And I've been all across Europe looking at very carefully at refugee camps, staging sites, you know, emergency refugee shelters, and very provisional pop-up little refugee camps with tents and things all along borders that they're bottlenecks. And, you know, I spent 4 years making this work, and a lot of this stuff we don't want to see anymore, and we'd like to look away. We don't want to even see it to begin with. And a lot of them, these places are very provisional, and they're a year later, I've returned to some of these sites and they've totally disappeared. They've been cleaned up and disavowed, and we've forgotten they were ever there.
The other aspect that I wanted you to explain a little bit more to us about, if you would, Richard, I mean, I'm thinking specifically about, I think it's an incoming, and in one of the images, this boat coming over the horizon, we see the sea in front of us, this bubbling sea in front of us, and then this rubber dinghy, let's face it, it's a big rubber dinghy, but that's all it is, with people piled on board. How shocking was it to you to look down the lens, you know, from 30 kilometres and see that?
On the island of Lesbos, where I was making a lot of that imagery, there was 1,000 of those boats per day. Each one had at least 30 people crammed on. So you can imagine the scale of it, and it's a very small island. Imagine the impact on the island and the collective trauma. And sometimes, unfortunately, we would witness a boat turning over or sinking, and we recorded, you know, the most tragic human trafficking disaster in living memory on the Aegean Sea, and that was a scene from hell. There were many people drowning or in the state of drowning and hypothermic coming off that boat, and we recorded the entire rescue effort, which was botched, of course, because of very confused immigration laws, and it happened in international waters. And it was the worst thing I've ever seen. And we were graced with the camera that was designed exactly to image that sort of thing from a great distance, that was able to pinpoint the human souls on the water being carried by the tide.
Would you have ethical concerns, or, you know, concerns around filming and actually showing, you know, people dying, people drowning on camera, and maybe less even so when we see very private moments at times when people land? What ethical concerns have you got when you're, it could be termed, look, you know, really getting inside people's private moments and really difficult moments in that way?
Yeah, no, exactly. I have, you know, I think there's a moral imperative for a photographer to tell these stories and not to look away, and for to tell them in a meaningful, more adequate way, in a powerful way that transcends mere spot news that, you know, we see and we forget immediately. And a lot of that imagery from those times is quite forgettable, because we're saturated with the same kind of images. We're seeing them over and over again. And, you know, I suppose my artistic practice is all based on trying to resuscitate and revive and make more urgent some of these things that I've witnessed myself, which I want you to see. It's testimonial. I think it's very important that we remember that this is happening on our shores, and that we are complicit and responsible for some of these things that are unfolding. We're not sitting 30 kilometres away from a lot of the things in the film. In fact, we went relatively close, you know, as close as a normal photojournalist. But we had the luxury of this extraordinarily powerful super telescopic cameras, so we could actually telescope in on very tender moments that were unfolding in front of us, or not that close, but we could really see. And because we slow down the footage in a way, we really get a sense of intimate sense of some of the human little moments of, you know, following a very traumatic landing. For example, a Syrian woman looks up with great hesitancy at her husband and a young couple, you know, and they have gotten past the, you know, the most probably dangerous part of their journey, but it's only beginning, you know, and that there's a great sense of relief, but also anxiety in her look. And these are really human moments that all of us can relate to, no matter what culture or language or wherever you're from. So I think it's really important to universalize these narratives in that way and to allow all of us to feel them. Now, the camera, it does so in a way that, yes, feels a little bit invasive. And that feeling undermines the imagery, not undermines it, undercuts it. It's sort of a subtext of the imagery that sort of puts the viewer on edge slightly. But also, because it's thermal, we're not seeing reflected heat, we're not seeing visible light, we're seeing thermal heat print, you know, sort of a heat signature of relative temperature difference within the given frame. This is a very odd way of seeing. We're not actually able to identify these individuals. They are anonymized by the camera. Yeah. And this is of crucial importance to the work because, you know, we have to think about consent.
Yes.
And these people are in the act of, according to some of our governments, in the act of breaking the law, they're regarded as illegal immigrants. Yeah. I believe they're refugees. But they may want to not be identified. And that anonymizing quality of the camera allows me to work in a way that I feel is actually quite ethical and respectful.
Perfect. Okay, listen, enjoy. Thanks for being with us this evening, Richard, and enjoy the homecoming.
Great, I will, yeah. And actually, I think we'll be having a concert, depending on travel restrictions. Ben Frost, who collaborated on the sound, hopefully in early August, will be doing, as part of Kilkenny Arts Week, an outdoors concert performance. And I'm really hoping that goes ahead, but who knows? Thank you so much.
Well, here's hoping that that does go ahead. And Richard Moss there telling us about his upcoming installations. The Butler Gallery, in partnership with Kilkenny Arts Festival, present the Irish premiere of Richard Moss's Incoming and Grid Moria. They run from the 11th of June through to the 29th of August as part of Brightening Air Cushcaim Quilly. And you can find out full details on butlergallery.ie. Just coming up to 21 minutes to 8 in Wednesday night's arena. Toby Omotesso is a nationally and internationally acclaimed Nigerian Irish break dancer and hip-hop freestyle dancer. He has performed his own work at the Dublin Dance Festival and been part of numerous music videos, as well as working with some of Ireland's leading choreographers, including David Bulger, Fidget Feet and Catherine Young. As a recipient of the Midsummer Commission, he will present a celebration of Ireland's street art, hip-hop, dance and music scene for the Cork Midsummer Festival. And I'm delighted to be joined by Toby on the programme now. Let's go back, Toby, if I could, to how you came to breakdancing yourself. Was this after your move to Ireland? I know you've moved from Nigeria. You were in the UK, I think, for about a year or so. Mm-hmm. And then you came to Ireland. At what point did breakdancing really, or dancing, become part of your vocabulary, if you like, in Ireland?
That's a great question. And to start off, just want to thank the whole team and the crew for having me as well. So for me, it's a really funny moment, because I remember a specific moment when I was about 12, and I'd done like a head spin, right? I'd done this head spin on the grass, and I made like a circle in the grass. And I can remember, I can briefly or vaguely remember how that felt, and the onlookers, how they actually were like almost stunned. But at that, my dad was like, my parents were just like, well, you don't want to break your neck there, do you?
They had other things on their mind. But it's interesting, you speak about the onlookers who were totally amazed at what you were doing. This was in Kildare, I think, Toby, and your initial experience when you came from Nigeria via the UK to Ireland, your initial experience was not quite so positive here, I think.
Yeah. I mean, of course. And at that time, it was like right after the Celtic Tiger broke out, and then there was like an influx of immigrants and non-nationals that actually came through to Ireland back then, and Nigeria would be looking to Ireland and UK because we shared similar history, and also we actually speak the same English-speaking country. We speak English. So at that time, it was like literally alien to see anything but, you know, white, pale, Irish skin, you know, on the street. And then when they see like a dark-colored human being walking on the street, you know, it was taken with somewhere obviously positive, But majority of it was not a positive experience, especially for like a 11-year-old kid and 12-year-old kid at that time.
And did dance change that then? Were you suddenly, the cool kid on the block who could spin on his head without breaking his neck?
Without breaking my neck, yeah. And I suppose I was quite active anyways. You know, growing up as a kid, my older brother was really into his, you know, soccer. And that community was just the African community back then and the traveling community, actually. Where just like, obviously, we played soccer. But for me, I don't know. There was just something in me that says, like, I can kind of do more than playing soccer. So, like, I saw a movie, parkour. So parkour is like when people actually jump from buildings to buildings to escape, like, the feds. You know, that's why it was created back in France and Russia. And I took to that because obviously I was being chased, you know. I was being, you know, so I saw it as a way, okay, if I can do something they cannot do, then I'm safe. So I saw it as a mechanism to keep me safe on the streets, I suppose.
Yeah, get yourself out of trouble if trouble That's was coming it. Coming towards you, that, even though you may not have been doing anything wrong at all. Another very interesting aspect of this for me, Toby, is the fact that I'm looking at the videos today and I'm thinking, well, obviously, Toby spent ages training as a dancer and now he's a professional dancer. But there's dancing for you is not necessarily an end in itself or a way of making money. It serves another function in your life because you have a whole other academic side to your life as well.
Yeah. I mean, I work as a automation and network engineer, and I have a BSc in applied electronics engineering. I have another BEng in software development, and a whole rick of degrees and certs. And for me, so for me, because I came from a family whereby obviously we value education first and foremost in my household, and I never really thought dance was a way out in a sense, you know. Dance was gonna put food on my table, you know, or on the table. Or fend for my family. So it wasn't something that came naturally to go study. So, but it was the most important activity I could have ever came in contact with as a young adult, as a teenager, and even still now, and coping with the environment we find ourselves. And it's the single art form that has stayed with me, thick and teen, throughout all my adolescence. And my adult, you know, and I've done it when I was in school, when I was in primary school, when I was in secondary school, college, working, you know, uni. I've always done that. So it serves a much more deeper and richer purpose. Mm.
And when did you set up the dance studio then in Waterford, and what did you hope to achieve from that with that studio?
So in Waterford, we set up a breakbeat. It was called Breakbeat Dance School, and I was the head teacher and the choreographer there. And it was in conjunction. I done it with a amazing facilitator called Deidre Dempsey, and it was right there because we saw there was a lot of youths at that time. It was back in 2008, 2009, and it ran for about 5 years. It ran about 5 years. But then we just saw that dance touched these youths and teenagers, particularly either boy, girl, and from different cultures. And the diversity and the range of people you come in contact with, it was just a really, 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 really fuller experience for people that actually came in. And we dare not stop when we saw the uptake in it. And it's a way of getting, and fitness was involved as well. So it was just, it was a no-brainer, really, that we have to keep doing this.
And in some ways, I think what you've curated then for Midsummer, as this Midsummer celebration, it really feeds into that community aspect, that feeling you have around dance and how it should be about people partaking as well as just sitting down and watching it. The event that you're organising, you can be there in person at the event. Well, 15 people can, or you can watch from home. Explain what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, Cork Summer Festival celebration, it's literally a burst of celebration of artistry. And we use the means of music. We use the means of graffiti and street art and obviously dance. And rap, spoken word. So because I'm from a culture, obviously I stem across, I would say, three cultures. So obviously my where I was born, Nigeria, and I grew up in Ireland, and then I am heavily invested in the hip hop culture, and which has elements of breakdancing, which have elements of MCing, which is rap and music. And graffiti. So from all that, culture is literally showcased on stage. And because when I was growing up, that's what spoke to me. Yeah. That's what I could identify with.
What you want people to do is the venue is the Elizabeth Fort in Cork. People can go there. Yes. I think it's only 15 people can be present at that. But they can also watch online. They can dance at home in their own sitting rooms, or they can dance outside if they want to. The important thing is to partake. That's your plan. Yeah.
Partake, because the choreographers are going to be teaching some steps that you can do in your house. If you're there on the day, Elizabeth Court, of course, with social distancing and all that COVID measures in place, in a safe environment, and just to experience something different and new and refreshing.
Lots of ways to do it. And congratulations on the commission, Toby, and hope that it all goes very well for you. That's Toby Omotesso there. And details of Toby's A Midsummer Celebration can be found on corkmidsummer.com. The death last month of Seamus Dean represented a huge loss to the world of Irish literary criticism. A poet, a novelist, but above all a trenchant and insightful critic, Dean leaves behind a formidable body of work, much of which is encapsulated in the posthumously published Small World, Ireland 1798 to 2018. Joseph Cleary, Professor of English at Yale, who wrote the foreword to Small World, joins us on the programme now. As I mentioned there, Joe, we have this formidable body of work. How would you describe Seamus Dean's status as a literary critic?
I don't think it's any exaggeration to say that Seamus Dean is probably one of the finest, if not the finest, Irish essayist of the 20th century. In the United States, the essay is regarded as something of an art form. It's taught at undergraduate level. And if you go into the bookstores, you will see, best essays of 2019 or 2020. Collected annually. In Ireland, I think the form is neglected, but certainly I would say Seamus, just for sheer style, integrity of his thought, and kind of the synoptic assurance with which he was able to range from the 18th century up to the present, made him, a remarkable essayist, a superb exponent of the form.
Yeah, and I suppose in recent times, maybe the essay has started to grow in popularity with many younger writers now partaking in the form in a way that
absolutely,
they hadn't done previously.
Yeah.
Seamus, he was born in Derry in 1940, Joe. It's so important, the time and the place here, in terms of his formation, both as a man and as a critic, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Derry Bogside background is essential to any appreciation of Seamus's work and of his career. I think in some ways, too, it has led to a kind of misconception of his work. His work has sometimes been categorized as cultural nationalist, whereas I think both Seamus's work, certainly, and the Field Day Theatre Company's work could be much better described as civic republican than cultural nationalist. From very early on in his career, in his doctoral dissertation, he studied how British cultural nationalism had been formed as a reaction to French republicanism and later to Irish republicanism. And then, of course, Irish cultural nationalism was formed as a counterpoint or reaction to British cultural nationalism. And in many ways, Seamus Dean was a very highly informed critic of both of those cultural nationalisms.
Yeah, and of course...
The very background did leave its obvious impression on the work, maybe particularly all of the work, but maybe particularly in the 1980s when he published the Field Day pamphlets, Civilians and Barbarians, in 1983 and Heroic Styles in 1986.
Both of those are actually in this collection. Certainly, Civilians and Barbarians is there. That's aspect of Dean's work, his facility to be European. You know, to reference Proust, to reference Kafka, politics, psychoanalysis, all of that across this collection as well. In some ways, it's you see parallels in the way you talk about this reductive aspect of some of the analysis of his criticism. In the very first chapter in the book, Swift as Classic, we see something similar. Swift writing these grotesque satires, if you like, of Irish society at the time, but they were dismissed precisely because of that. Oh, that's grotesque. There's something wrong with that man if he's writing in that fashion.
Yeah, he has a wonderful passage in the Swift essay where he talks about, you know, how Swift characterizes the modern as a form of madness, as a form of obsessive dementia almost. But that the scholarly interpretations of Swift often then applied that madness or dementia to Swift himself as a way to explain the ferocity, I suppose, of his critiques. And yeah, you could argue, I think you're suggesting, that there's a way in which, in essays like, or in pamphlets like Civilians and Barbarians, the way in which Dean argues how significant that whole binary, between the civilian and the barbarian was to colonial discourse in Ireland. And in a way, in which the way in which it sort of continued on into the present, and he was very determined to sort of break down that binarism and to open up a new language for thinking about conflict and thinking about relations between nationalist and unionist, British and Irish, and so on in his work.
But interestingly enough, though, he doesn't always just you might expect then at times, well, he'll always have this European outlook and he'll take anything positive in that respect. But he quotes T.S. Eliot at one point, describing Joyce's Ulysses as, quote, the first Irish work since that of Swift to possess absolute European significance. I don't think Seamus Dean was in total accord with that aspect or that critique of Joyce's work, was he?
No, not at all. I mean, he was very alert and very attentive to the European dimensions of Joyce. But in the essay that you're mentioning there, he says that statement where Eliot links Joyce to Swift and says they're really the two only significant Irish, that Joyce is the only really significant writer since Swift, or the only European writer since Swift. And he says in some ways that's an indication of how little Eliot really knew about the Irish tradition. Yeah, Seamus's work is, very assuredly European. He studied the French Revolution, the British reception of the French Revolution, and he was also deeply versed in the Frankfurt School criticism, from the 1930s into the 1950s and 60s. So it has that incredible range. It's always located in Irish concerns, but those Irish concerns in turn are contextualized in a much sort of broader European and American, it has to be said, too, framework.
Yeah, interestingly enough, in the final essay in the book, the End of the World, we are given both a European and an American context here. He starts with the story of the Helga and how it was the boat that shelled the GPO in 1916 during the Rising. And then he goes on to talk about the Lusitania and the sinking of the Lusitania and the loss of Hugh Lane and others, obviously, on that as well. Starting out an essay about the end of the world, as he puts it, with those two boats, What does that set up that he can argue further into the essay?
It's a really magnificent essay. It's a long and arabesque essay in many respects. But basically what he's getting at there, Seamus never writes simple thesis essays. You won't find a simple thesis statement in any of these essays. But there are wonderful passages about when the Lusitania is sunk and the way in which this sort of bonanza of commodities and goods washes up in the Blasket Islands. And the Blasket Islanders, of course, are a very impoverished population, subsistence population in many respects. So this boon, which comes from a disaster, is something that Dean comments on wonderfully. But behind all of that essay, I think there's really a sense that the way in which the Helga went from a ship that did the Clare Island survey to becoming the gunboat, the Helga, to then being taken into the Free State Marine Service, is a kind of passage from the calamity of history into what appears like the calms of post-history. Yeah. But then creeping up behind that, there is, you know, what we now call climate crisis or eco-catastrophe. Mm. And there's a way in which, you know, the fate of the Blasket Islanders, as they, you know, the islands will eventually be abandoned. The fate of the Irish ascendancy, which has given Ireland so many of its writers. And then just the fate of the human species as such all proved to be remarkably precarious. It's also an essay about the passage from, I suppose, British world domination or British hegemony to American hegemony. That's partly behind it, you know, why World War II is a significant moment for Seamus there.
It really is. It's a phenomenal collection of essays in terms of its range and the ideas that are within it. And indeed, your own foreword sets it up very well for us. Thanks for being with us this evening, Joe.
Not at all. Thank you.
That's Joe Cleary, who has written the foreword to that posthumous publication from Seamus Dean, Small World, Ireland, 1978 to 2018, which is published by Cambridge University Press. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening here in Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Ruth Kennington was on sound this evening. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Tomorrow night on the programme, films up for review. We'll actually be talking about films that are in cinemas. That is happening tomorrow night here on Arena. So lots to look forward to there.